So this is work that I've been doing in Vienna together with Alessio Benenke, Charles Buchner, and Esteban Castrovoz during my PhD. And it's about quantum reference frames. And I'm going to talk about the possibility of considering reference frames as a quantum system. Well, quantum systems as reference frames, both in when we want to define spatial reference frames and temporal reference frames. So first, before starting, let me just tell you what we usually mean by a reference frame in physics. So typically, when we set a reference frame, we set a set of axes and a set of motion. And usually, we treat reference frames as abstract entities that are useful for us to fix the point of view from which observations are carried out. But the idea of reference frames is very important because we have the principle of covariance that tells us that regardless of the reference frame that we pick, then the laws of physics are not going to change. And so let us imagine that we have this initial reference frame and then we want to go to a different reference frame. In quantum mechanics, typically we would apply a reference frame transformation that can be a translation, a boost, or anything else. And typically, it's represented as a unitary operator, where what I would like to stress here is that the relation between the old reference frame and the new reference frame enters in this transformation as a parameter. So it's not a dynamical degree of freedom, basically. And then once we have this transformation, we also know how to transform the dynamical law. And this is the condition that we need in order to have a Schrödinger equation in the new reference frame. And then we say that the reference frame transformation is a symmetry transformation if the functional form of the Hamiltonian in the final reference frame is the same as the functional form of the Hamiltonian in the initial reference frame. So when we think about it a bit more carefully, we notice that actually, every time that we carry out an observation, we use physical systems. So I will use a physical ruler to measure distances. And also, I will take as reference a physical object. So if I want to measure the distance between the blackboard and the desk, I will just put the ruler here on the blackboard, and I will measure the distance to the desk. So we measure the relative distance between the blackboard and the desk. But we know that physical systems are ultimately quantum. And so, for instance, they can be in a superposition state of two different states, like gamma 1 and gamma 2, here I call them. And so the natural question that arises at this point is, can we associate a reference frame to a quantum particle whose state is in a quantum superposition in some basis? And this reference frame that we associate to this quantum particle is what we are going to call quantum reference frames. And just as a disclaimer, this is not about space-time fuzziness. So we are not checking the fundamental limitation of space-time or some fundamental discreteness. These are just classical reference frames in the sense that I can define perfectly what a reference frame is. They are just in a quantum relationship, one with respect to the other. And so this is the outline of my talk. And so the first part of the talk is about formalism that is contained in this paper here. And for quantum reference frames in a Galilean setting. And I will just give you an overview of the formalism, then I will show you some results. And the second part of the talk is about some new work, which is the temporal version of these reference frames that we call time reference frames. And in particular, after introducing the formalism, I will tell you how this is related to another research line of my former group in Vienna, that is the indefinite causality. So let us start with the quantum reference frames for space. So our perspective is we want to take a relational view. So we do not want any absolute space. And we only want to consider relative quantities, so like relative distances or relative distances in particular. And the way, so to understand how this works, we can imagine that we have a set of n particles, and this black box would be the absolute space in which they're embedded. And we basically do not want this black box. We want to get rid of this box. So the way we can do that is we take the perspective of this orange particle here, and then we have n minus one relational degrees of freedom that are represented by these arrows here. And these tell us what the relational degrees of freedom from the point of view of these orange particles are. And now if we want to change to a different reference frame, so to a different particle in this case, then we will pick another particle. And you see, we still have n minus one arrows, but they're a bit, or they're organized differently. And technically, this means that the partition of our total Hilbert space will be a different one according to the quantum reference frame that we will pick. So there's nothing quantum so far, I'm just introducing the language. Okay, so let's consider the simplest situation we can, which is given by three particles. C will be our initial reference frame, A will be our final reference frame, and B is a quantum system that is there because both C and A describe it. So C describes A and B, A describes B and C. And let us associate from the point of view of C some relative distance between C and A and some relative distance between C and B that we will call X A or on the X.
And all three are quantum particles.
All three are quantum particles, yeah. It's just that C does not describe itself, basically. Because it's the relational, is it? So if we now want to go to the relative coordinates to A, then it's easy to see by just some vector composition that that is the transformation that we want. And now let us fix some initial reference frame. So this will be C, the origin of C's reference frame. And let us describe B. And for a moment, let's just consider what happens in case we want to move to a reference frame that is simply rigidly translated from the origin. And in quantum mechanics, we know how to do that. We just apply that unitary operator that sends us to a new origin of the reference frame alpha. But now, what happens if instead of having a sharply localized reference frame here, I want to describe that the quantum state of B from the point of view of this state? So here I wouldn't know which position to pick. So one possibility is to take seriously the linearity of quantum mechanics and say, okay, I will just translate by every possible value on the real axis, but then I expect this point, for instance, to count more than this point. So I can weigh the translation on the state of A. And if I do this, I obtain this operator here, where if you compare it with the one that I have on top, I had to add an additional Hilbert space that is the Hilbert space of the particle that I'm taking to define the reference frame. And I had to promote the parameter of the transformation to an operator on the Hilbert space of the quantum reference frame. And clearly this is more general because it allows me, so now this is a product state, but I could consider any quantum state, entangled, mixed, pure. And this is not the end of the story because I still need to add this operator here that we call parity swap that sends x to minus x, p to minus p, and also swaps the labels a and c. And this is basically to take care of the transformation between A and C. So I want to swap the description between A and C. So basically I want to achieve the first line of that transformation there. This is still a unitary transformation. So I can transform the quantum state in this way. So to get familiar with how this transformation works, let us consider just some examples. And I have the same setting. I start from C and I want to go to A. So this is just to say that in case when A is sharply localized in position basis, everything works as it should. So in this case, if I go to C, what I expect to see and what I find when I apply the operator to the state is that A will see C in minus the position that A had from the point of view of C, and B will just be rigidly translated. Now, a slightly more complicated situation is when I have two well-localized states in position basis for A, but in a superposition, so x1 plus x2. But still, A and B are in a product state. Now, in this case, I would expect that for every position that A has, I have something like that. I have a translation of this type because the formalism is linear. But if I apply the transformation to that, this is what happens. But this means that I have a control translation on the position of A. So what I get is an entangled state where the relative distance is precisely the one that I would expect. So actually, this is a general feature of this formalism, that entanglement and superposition are not frame independent features, but they depend on the point of view from which I'm looking. So I cannot assign them a priori, but in every different quantum reference frame, I have to, well, they can change.
Just to clarify here, the reference frame then is from this purely from this relation point of view.
Yeah.
So when you say entanglement, it is with respect to, you're taking this product space state. So it's with respect, so it's a different partitioning of your space.
Yes, yes,
so
yes.
Different partitions you expect will give you different entanglements.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Thanks. So, I can also go the other way around. So I start from an entangled state where the relative distance between A and B is always L. And then in this case, if I move to the reference frame of A, I find that B is in a sharply localized state around position L from A's point of view, and C is in a superposition. And this is in a product state. So this is not an entangled state.
Does the entangled state determine uniquely the reference frame? Could you do the opposite and recover your reference frame?
This is invertible, so I can go back and forth.
So, and it's uniquely.
Yeah.
So there's one entangled state that has one unique reference frame.
If I have the state and the transformation, I can go back and forth. And then I can just generalize this to an EPR state that is, well, this is the non-normalized version of the EPR state, where the relative distance between A and B is always this big X. And if I go to the reference frame of A, then B will be localized around this big X, and C will be spread out over the whole space. So this is one of the results that I wanted to present. So the take-home message is that entanglement and superposition are quantum reference frame dependent features. And now we said that we want to associate a quantum reference frame to a physical system, but physical systems also have a Hamiltonian. So we will start assuming that from the point of view of C, I have a Schrödinger equation for A and B, where A is my quantum reference frame. So this is in addition to the usual what I would usually do in quantum mechanics, where I do not have any dynamical degree of freedom of my reference frame. And now, let us say that we want to apply a quantum reference frame transformation that at this level is simply a unitary transformation, which could explicitly depend on time. So it's not any specific transformation. And if I do that, I find that from the point of view of A, I still have a Schrödinger equation where I have to, so the evolution is still unitary, where the state is transformed in this way, and the Hamiltonian transforms in a very similar way to what we've seen before in standard quantum mechanics. The only difference is that here I have the Hilbert spaces of B and C, and here I have the Hilbert spaces of A and B. And this allows me to define what we mean by an extended symmetry transformation, which is, if I start in the reference frame of C with some Hamiltonian that is a some functional form and depends on the mass, position, and momentum of A and B, then after the transformation, I find a Hamiltonian that has the same functional form, but all where all the labels A are replaced by label C.
So this S here is the exponential of that infinitesimal, the red box. Is that right? Is S unitary or not? S hat.
Is what? Sorry?
Unitary or not?
It's unitary, yeah.
So
that's
the exponential version of the thing that you're showing in the box.
The exponential, well, you just apply on the left and on the right, and the calculation.
Yes. So what is
S? S is an H transformation. It's a transformation from one left to the other.
You had the earlier slide with
Earlier you showed with S once.
This?
S is, yeah.
Well,
is that the same S?
No, it's just, it's a general S.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a general S.
Yeah, so let's just go back again to the slide again. The point that you were showing just now. Yeah, so I'm just confused here. So the density matrix, the state BC,
yeah?
The state of it's a state of what? I'm sorry.
It's the quantum state of particle B and C from the point of view of A.
Point of view of A. Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I missed that. Okay. Then you're just looking at
So you're essentially relating the Hamiltonian from different reference frame Hamiltonians.
Yes.
You're saying that it will generically have that form? Is that the claim?
In general, it will have, well, this is the way I transform the Hamiltonian, yes? And then the specific form will depend on the initial Hamiltonian on the transformation that I pick. I'll give an example now, so maybe this will get clear. Okay, so this is this is the simplest example of this more general transformation. And this is the superposition of translations. So first of all, I have to define what it means, because a translation usually is rigid, so it doesn't change with time. So in this case, I will associate my reference frame. I want to describe relative coordinates to the relative to the state of A at time zero. It can be any time, just to fix the ideas, it's time zero. So basically, I consider an initial state for A and B from the point of view of C, where for simplicity, I just take here A to be a superposition of x1 and x2, and B is any one quantum state. And now we want to describe everything relative to that position there, to the superposition of x1 and x2. And to start with, always for simplicity, we take the free particle Hamiltonian. And then the transformation that achieves the superposition of translations is this one, where you can recognize here the transformation that I gave you initially. So basically, this would be a translation that when the dynamics is frozen. But here I needed to add also these additional terms. And then if I transform.
What is pi hat?
This pi hat?
The pi hat, the left angle pi hat.
Pi is the momentum in the new reference frame. So it just to distinguish the position and momentum between the initial and the final frame. It's the momentum of C once, because it's after this parity swap operator. So we are already in the new reference frame. And okay. So once I apply this transformation here, I find that the Hamiltonian is, again, free particle Hamiltonian. But wherever I had A there, I have C here. And so this is what we mean by an extended symmetry transformation in this case.
So in this case, was the Hamiltonian for C also free particle? I'm confused. Here we just have a Hamiltonian of A and B as seen by C.
Yes.
Was there independently a Hamiltonian of
no, because C does not describe itself, because we stand in the reference frame of C. So we only, if we have three particles, we have n minus one degrees of freedom, relational degrees of freedom. So basically, we describe two degrees of freedom, which are the relative degrees of freedom between C and A and the relative degrees of freedom between C and B.
Okay, so both those Hamiltonians are defined independently, and you're saying that this transformation does map one to another. Is that?
Well, we say this is the description in the initial reference frame. We define the transformation to a new reference frame, and we calculate this Hamiltonian.
Right, but I mean, you can, the transformation is defined so that you will have a symmetry, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. We look for the transformation that achieves the symmetry.
But
yeah.
I would like to say that, well, I got these three particles, right? I'm seeing the system, and,
yes.
and A and B are, is that right? And A and B are the reference frames, right?
A and, well, initially C and then A, yeah.
Yeah.
C is the reference frame, and then later A is the reference frame.
Yes.
C is the system.
C, no.
New reference frame.
C is the reference frame.
Okay.
Then she's switching to A is the reference
frame. Okay, so A and C are reference frames.
Yes.
So, but I could have said that, well, you are doing this work there, saying that this dynamics is happening this way. But I choose from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I could have an independent notion of what the Hamiltonian is for the reference frame A.
Yes.
How we describe B and C.
Mm-hmm.
Independently, I would have that. Supposing I have that independently.
Mm-hmm.
I would also write down, and there must be some implicit assumption that my Hamiltonian would also be this. And that, in other words, you don't know that my Hamiltonian is this.
Okay.
But you just began with this with the Hamiltonian of A and B as seen by C. Okay. But if I'm given this system, I know all the interactions.
Yes.
Therefore, they should also be independently Hamiltonian of E and C as seen by A.
There's an initial assumption, which was in the beginning, that the entire system is translation invariant.
Okay.
And so this is a Hamiltonian in the gauge where XC is equal to zero. And she computes the transformation to the gauge where XA is equal to zero.
So what I'm saying is also true now. Okay. It's true because of the assumption.
Yeah, you first have the symmetry.
So, okay. This is something that I'm not going to talk about in this talk, but you can recover this same formalism. Okay, so there are different ways in which you can recover this formalism also. One possibility is that you start with a system with some global translational invariants, for instance, and then you can go to the reference frame of A or C, classically, by just fixing the gauge where xA is equal to zero or xC is equal to zero. And then the transformation that sends you from one to the other is, well, actually, it's this one. You can also do it for this more complicated one, but we don't have it in a paper. And then in the quantum case, you have a projection over the classical gauge conditions. So this is what achieves.
But you agreed with Bianca, right? Because I understood her answers.
Okay.
I was just translating.
Thanks. Okay. So if there are no more questions, I'll just go to the time version of the reference frames. Okay. So first of all, we said that we want to assign a reference frame to a quantum clock. What is a quantum clock? So the simplest quantum clock that I can consider is a two-level system, which has a Hamiltonian. So this is just energy level E0, energy level E1. And then I initialize my system in a superposition of its eigenstates, energy eigenstates, so that when I apply time evolution here, I will get a relative phase here. And then I say that the precision of the clock is given by this orthogonalization time. That is the time that it has to elapse in order for this state to have a minus here instead of a plus. So here, what I would like you to notice is that the bigger I make the energy gap, the more precise the clock will be. And now, what happens if I put two clocks, one next to the other? So I know that the mass energy equivalence holds. So basically, if the internal energy will also contribute to the mass of the clock. So these clocks, if I put them one close to the other, should interact gravitationally with their mass. But if the energy also contributes to the mass, then if the clock is in this E0 state, then there will be some time dilation of this clock, which will depend on this E0. If the clock will be in E1, then this clock will be time dilated differently according to E1. So this can be captured by the Hamiltonian there that I wrote. This is an interaction picture. And then let's see. So we said that we have the orthogonalization time for this clock, that is the precision of this clock that is given by this. And then for the clock on the right-hand side, basically, we said that we have this difference between these time dilations given by E0 and E1. And this difference here, so the difference of the rate at which the clock ticks, whether when this clock is in E0 or in E1, is given by this quantity. And now, if I multiply them, I find some fundamental limitation in how well these two clocks can tick according to when they interact with each other gravitationally. So I have some, and this is independent of the energy gap of these two clocks.
But it depends on the Hamiltonian you chose, no?
It depends on the Hamiltonian, yes. So basically, it looks like these clocks are not good clocks anymore when I put them one close to the other and I want them to measure time, because one clock will ruin the other clock. So one possibility that we considered in that paper is to look at everything from the point of view of a faraway observer that is far enough from them so that he doesn't feel the difference between the two energy levels. But actually, we want to be in a region that is close to the clock to know what happens when the clocks measure time. So in this talk, what we're going to do is to see if we can jump to the reference frame of one of these clocks and see how the clock itself describes the dynamics of what is around it. And in order to do that, we are going to consider a timeless formalism for quantum mechanics. So we will build on these results, and so in particular on the Page and Wooters formalism. So now I will switch from a qubit description of the clock to a continuous variable description. And I will have this constraint here that is formed by the free Hamiltonian of the clocks plus some interaction that, to fix the ideas, we can consider the gravitational interaction between the clocks. And then I know that the physical state is the state that annihilates the constraint, and I can represent it in that way. So now, if I want to go to the perspective of clock I, for instance, I will condition on the time that the clock I reads. And I will find the state of all the other clocks at time ti of this clock.
Can I ask a question? So, do these clocks fall into each other?
No, at the moment they're static. They don't have any dynamics. So these are just the degrees of freedom of time degrees of freedom. So they don't move.
But then there must be something that holds them in their place, right?
Yes, this is a toy model. So
it should not be part of the Hamiltonian as well. Whatever that you ask that place.
Yeah, if you want to make a more sophisticated model, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is like in flat space time, I suppose.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, but that's gravity, right?
They made assumption.
It's just a gravitational Newton potential, which is between.
That's what I'm saying, and that causes them to fall on top of each other, unless something.
But these are different degrees of freedom. So the degree of freedom that we are considering here, this Ti, is not the dynamical degree of freedom, like the spatial degree of freedom. So you would have to add more degrees of freedom and consider a more complicated Hamiltonian. So we are simplifying here, we are just neglecting something.
It's not quantum gravity.
Oh, it's just quantum.
It's quantum gravity, that's how you go.
Just bolt the clocks down to the table. The table isn't going
yes,
to be changing in time. So.
Yeah.
No, I guess I'm just worried that, I mean, you have phonons, I guess, to your table that gives you additional attraction that might be more important than the gravitational. So basically, I think whatever you're ignoring might be the biggest thing that in the problem. That's what I'm worried about. Because, yeah, that's the final part. Like, as you said, if you put things on the table, they communicate through phonons on the table. That might be more important than gravitational attraction.
Okay, and then if you do that, you find this equation here. So the constraint becomes this, where this is not yet a Schrödinger equation because of this part. And now, for instance, one thing one can do is to say, okay, but actually this clock is far away. So I will send this lambda ik to zero. And in this case, I recover the clock Hamiltonian from the faraway observer.
Sorry, I think I missed. What's the state Ti?
So you have the Hamiltonian Hi, the free Hamiltonian, and this is canonically conjugated to some operator Ti, and this state Ti is the eigenvector of the T operator that is canonically conjugated to the free Hamiltonian of the clock.
So when lambda goes to zero, does this then make the Hamiltonian or the dynamics local?
Local?
In the sense that you have no longer the two clocks close to each other, where you have a faraway.
You take the faraway observer, and then you can look at the Hamiltonian of the other clocks. That is basically the condition that we had in the previous paper. So when we stand far away from the clocks, and then you can recover precisely the same results. And now we want to go beyond that to basically, we do not want to assume. So what we will do is we take lambda ik to be small. So in this case, we can just basically invert this relation and expand it and use perturbation theory. And in this case, we find that we have this Schrödinger equation where this where I had to renormalize basically the h and the lambdas in this way. So basically, they will pick a term that depends on the ith clock here. OK, but now we also want to make measurements. And this is usually not trivial in this Page and Woodard's formalism because of a series of reasons, like the observable should commute with the constraint, for instance. And now, but there is a solution to that is given in these two papers, which is to purify what in quantum information terms we would say purify the measurement, which means that I don't only consider the two clocks and the system, but I also take an ancillary system M and I let it interact with the system. And then I project on the ancilla. And this guarantees that this projection does not take me out of the constraint surface. So this is the scheme. The ancilla interacts with the system, and then I measure the ancilla. So in this case, I have to add to the previous Hamiltonian this term here. So this is the measurement part, where this delta here, so this T operator here, tells me that when clock 2 says it's time Ti, then the interaction will happen. And the interaction is modeled by this operator on the system, on the state of, on the Hilbert space of the ancilla and of the system. And then I have this additional term here that is basically the time dilation factor on clock 2 due to clock 1. Okay. And now I'm almost ready to tell you what this has to do with indefinite causality. I just need to introduce one more thing, which is the gravitational switch, which is work by these people here. So I have two parties, Alice and Bob, and they have a clock in their local laboratory. And then I put the Earth here on the left, and then I know that the Earth will time dilate the clocks of A and B. But since lower is lower, the clock, A's clock will tick more slowly than B's clock. So this will be time T1, time T2, time T1, time T2. And now I can arrange the geometry in such a way that time equal to 2 in clock for clock A is in the future light cone of time equal to 2 for clock B. And then I can send the system that, and in such a way that the system reaches the laboratory always when the local clock says it's time equal to 2. And then they will apply some unitary operation on the system at this time when the system reaches the laboratory. And in this case, when the mass is on the left, I will have that B happens before A. Now I can take the opposite case when the mass is on the right, and basically I have to reverse A, what happens in A and B. So this clock this time will be slower than A's clock, and time equal to 2 for B will be in the future light cone of time equal to 2 for A, and the system will go first through A and then through B. And so basically A will happen before B. And now what happens if I put the Earth in a superposition? So it doesn't need to be the Earth, but just something massive that produces a gravitational field. It's a thought experiment. So the Earth will be in a superposition of being left and right. And then I will coherently superpose these two situations. And I will achieve a situation in which B and A are not ordered anymore, the operation in B and the operation in A. So I will have a superposition of the order of the local operations that A and B perform on the system. And this is called the gravitational switch. So I can represent it in this way. And now I want to write a constraint for, in this Page and Waters formalism, for this situation. And see here acts as the faraway observer. So this is the constraint. So you see that I have this phi I that is basically the gravitational, the Newtonian potential of the Earth, basically. Me is the mass of the Earth. So it's the time dilation that the Earth induces on the two clocks, on the three clocks, actually. And then I have the measurement of the system. So now what happens if I look at the operations in A and in B from the point of view of C and of A, for instance? So if I look at it from the point of view of C, I see that when the mass is on the right, A's operation happens from the point of, according to C, at some T star minus delta. You see that T star is the time at which the operation happens in according to A's clock. So C sees it at T star minus delta. And B happens at T star plus delta. So A is before B, and it's at these different times. And then if the mass is on the left, then A's operation happens at T star plus delta, and B's operation happens at T star minus delta. So B happens before A, and the role is reversed. So it's in a superposition, and they're both delocalized in time because they happen in a superposition of being at T star minus delta and T star plus delta. But now, if I look at them from A's point of view, I can see that regardless of the position of the mass, so if the mass is in, if the Earth is in R in left or right, A's operation always happens at T star, which is what I see there. So it's localized in time. And B's operation happens in a superposition of being before and after. So if the mass is on the right, it happens at T star plus epsilon. It's another quantity. And if the mass is on the left, it happens at T star minus epsilon. So again, the order is preserved. So once A is before B and once B is before A, but the localization of these events changes according to the perspective from which I'm looking. And okay, so basically this is all I wanted to tell you. And so I'm just going to summarize. So I've presented here an operational and relational formalism for quantum reference frames, for space, so for spatial quantum reference frames, and for time reference frames. And in the spatial case, that we have seen that the entanglement and superposition are quantum reference frame dependent features, and that we can extend the covariance of physical laws and introduce some extended symmetry transformations. And there are some results that I didn't cover. And then in the temporal case, we have, so I've just given you a motivation, an introduction to the formalism for interacting clocks. And then I've shown you how this is related to the indefinite causal order. And so this is, I would just wanted to thank my co-authors and thank you for your attention. Here's some useful literature in case you're interested.
So can you go back to your summary? You call it indefinite
causality,
and also that comes from the timeless quantum mechanics.
No, this is a different approach.
Okay, then forget the timeless. Would you say that is a violation of causality?
No, I wouldn't. Okay, thanks for the question, because that's an important point.
Let me just say something, and then you reply to the same thing, which is, I don't know if you're aware that Aronoff and his collaborators have a way of violating causality by what you call redshift causality, which is a solution to some paradoxes, but it essentially depends on a post-selection after a measurement.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to say, if you see there is any...
So you mean these two-time states formalism?
Yeah.
So I'm aware of that. So, okay. So here I'm referring to a specific formalism. We call it, that is used in my group in Vienna. And so... this is called the W matrix formalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say it's a violation of causality because you're not violating any signaling condition, you're not signaling faster than light or anything like that. You're just allowing causal relations to be in a superposition. And or even like in some wilder state. But this is a formalism that does not have any logical paradox. So you do not have things like the grandfather
they don't have as well, time signaling. Yeah, but it's just lucky that, so Lee and I discovered in our energetic models a type of causality which is not a violation of causality. We called it disordered causality. I'm glad though we didn't, we could have just called it indefinite causality as well. So it's a good thing that we didn't, right?
So, I mean, in answer to one of those questions, somebody was asking, what do you mean by strive TI? And you said, like, TI is just the variable conjugate to the Hamiltonian. You know that there is no variable Hamiltonian, conjugate of Hamiltonian, if the Hamiltonian is positive or even bounded below or something. So, are you really using these operator valued measures? That's what one has to use, you know, to talk about this TI. Is that what you're doing? Or are you, what is really your TI?
So, okay, this is a very simplified model. So then one thing you could do is to model the clock as an L-level clock, for instance. So this will have a Hamiltonian that is bounded from below. And then you will have some arbitrariness. So you will have some uncertainty, basically, in the way you define time. You won't have any measurement for time, but you will have a more physical situation that is a Hamiltonian that is bounded.
Right. But the wave function now is sort of function of this TI, which is state, which is approximate or something. Right?
Yeah, so you will have to basically take a very big N, so an N-level system with N very large, and then this you will achieve this as the limit when N goes to infinity, but then you want to restrict to a finite N.
And is it because you don't want to worry with operator valued measures, or what?
You don't want to?
The point is that you can take T T is not an operator, but on the other hand, it is an operator where it measures that various people like Frederick Hagel and then other people have worked out in great detail. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one could introduce a function using that framework. So my question was, have you thought about it and have you done it?
No, we haven't thought about it. That's the first result we have.
Okay, let's thank Flaminia again.